Yad B'Yad and the Cancer Connection program of Samost Jewish Family and Children's Service present Episode 5 in their podcast series, Coping with Cancer Through Spirituality, a Mind, Body, and Spiritual Approach to Healing. This program was recorded Monday, December 1st, 2008, at the Katz JCC in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hello, I'm Steve Lubetkin of ProfessionalPodcasts.com, your host for this program. In this program, our panelists are Dr. Diane Gillum, a breast surgeon, the Reverend Debbie Brincivalli of the Presbytery of West Jersey, Bonnie Mayer, director of the Diane Barton Complementary Medicine Program at Cooper University Hospital, and Rabbi Jeffrey Arnowitz of Congregation Bethel in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. This podcast runs about an hour and 2 minutes. And now we'll turn things over to Marjorie Dannenbaum of Jewish Family and Children's Service to introduce this evening's program.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. How are you? Thank you for coming out on this kind of rainy, chilly night. My name is Marjorie Dannenbaum, and I'm the Yad B'Yad and Cancer Program Coordinator at Samost Jewish Family and Children's Services of Southern New Jersey. As part of my responsibilities at JFCS, I'm lucky enough to help educate and support individuals and their families who are touched by cancer. This evening is an opportunity for you to learn about ways in which you or your loved ones can cope with a cancer diagnosis through spiritual means. Tonight, we will hear from Dr. Diane Gillum, a breast surgeon at Virtual Hospital, Reverend Debbie Brincivalli from the Presbytery of West Jersey, Rabbi Jeffrey Arnowitz from Congregation Bethel, and Bonnie Mayer, the director of the Diane Barton Complementary Medicine Program at Cooper University Hospital. I'm confident that they will help us find new ways to cope at a difficult time. At the conclusion of the presentations, there will be ample opportunity for individual questions. So if you do have a question, if I could just ask you to please wait until the end of the program. And for those of you who may not know, tonight's program is going to be podcast. And what that means is within the coming weeks, this program will be available on our websites and potentially the websites from our panelists, and you can listen from the comfort of your own home at any time. Your family members, people who maybe weren't feeling well enough to come tonight, can upload or download the podcast and listen to it. So in order for that to happen, we're going to pass the microphone around, and please just speak into the microphone when you ask your questions so the listeners at home can hear your questions as well as the answers. So thank you so much for coming, and without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Diane Gillum.
Thank you, Marjorie, very much, and you're all to be credited for coming out on this rainy, cold night, and certainly hope that you'll benefit from being here tonight. It's certainly my pleasure to be here. As Marjorie mentioned, the reason that I'm here is that I'm a breast surgeon, and my practice is exclusively involves breast disease, and as a result, I encounter and help women through the process of a breast cancer diagnosis and treatment. I want to make perfectly clear right from the get-go that when it comes to spirituality, I don't want you to think that I'm the expert. The experts are here. But what I hope to bring to this discussion is what I see in practice every day of how spirituality and spiritual strength helps women through the process of a diagnosis of breast cancer. That's actually one of the major reasons that I do what I do and enjoy it, because I get the opportunity to see patients who have tremendous issues that they must deal with. Oftentimes, the cancer diagnosis is just one of many difficult things that they're dealing with in their life. And it's quite a privilege for me to be involved in the healing process. It's also a learning experience for me to see the strength, the inner strength, that women can draw on along with their families and loved ones to get through these very difficult times. So in many ways, it's actually a learning experience for me. When it comes to spirituality, I was going to try to define it, and then I realized that was a little bit like grasping at a cloud. But I think some of the words that we think about most typically in association with spirituality are things such as faith, belief in a power that's greater than oneself, belief in a purpose in life or a purpose to things that happen in your life, the use of things such as prayer, meditation, and also a feeling of gratitude for the life that you have and the blessings that you have. I don't know that these things define spirituality, but to me, they're certainly the hallmarks or what makes up spirituality. When I was thinking about this discussion, I was wanted to be able to impress upon you what I, as a clinician, see are the benefits of spirituality and how it can be so helpful to patients going through the cancer diagnosis. And I knew in my heart what the answer was to that, I think, but I also actually looked in some of our medical literature about what studies, what actual factual information is out there about the impact of spirituality on cancer survival. And there are a number of studies out there looking at this issue, although it's a difficult one because, again, it's hard to find a tool to measure this concept adequately. But there have definitely been efforts to do this. And in looking at the literature, there are many benefits that I could see in various studies. Clearly, patients who have a strong spiritual background benefit in terms of issues such as stress reduction during diagnosis of illness. They have less depression. They tend to recover better. They have improvement in pain. They also appear to adjust to disability issues better and just overall are better able to cope with illness. And again, this was something that I felt that I see on a daily basis. But again, these are studies in our medical literature that point to the significance and the benefit of spiritual support. The American Cancer Society actually in 1991 did a study looking at their breast cancer support groups, and 85% of the women in their support groups felt that religion was an important part of their coping with their breast cancer diagnosis. I probably don't need to sell this audience on the benefit of spirituality. Could there be any risk? Could there be any downside to treating a patient with cancer who has a strong spiritual background? And I think that there can occasionally be clashes related to this. And again, looking at the medical literature, there are references to what is called the spiritual health locus of control. And what is really meant by that is, how does an individual look at what governs their health? And basically that falls into an active type of position or a passive type. And by that, by the active type, we mean that the patient understands that it's both their spiritual source or God, along with themselves, that impact on their health outcome. In the passive situation, a patient may believe that only God is in control of their health. And this can certainly be a challenge for us. There's actually evidence in the literature in a lot of work has been done in the Afro-American community where there's often a belief that God will take care of this, that I will leave this in God's hands. And that kind of spiritual approach can be certainly concerning or problematic for us as physicians. Overall, though, I think that there's tremendous reason to encourage and develop patients in terms of their spiritual support systems. And as physicians, I think one of our jobs ideally should be to support ideas of hope and wellness. And this can be done in many different ways. And again, our experts are going to help us understand that a little bit better. Sometimes for the physician, it can be a very difficult position, especially if we don't understand or have a knowledge of the patient's spiritual background. And again, this is where referring to pastoral support is a really important thing and something that ideally we should not forget. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the hospice program, but that's, in my opinion, and looking at the literature, the hospice program is an example of supporting hope, and you might not necessarily think of it in that regard, but actually what they are trying to do is really redirect in these situations of terminal illness to redirect hope into useful things such as supporting caring relationships at the end of life and understanding higher meanings. And again, I don't know how many of you have had interface with the hospice program, but patients that I see who are involved cannot tell me enough about how vital it was for both their affected family member and for the family itself and loved ones. And again, I think sometimes as practitioners, we don't utilize those kinds of services as much as we should. In another study I saw, about 77% of patients actually wanted their physicians to consider their spiritual needs. So as I wind down my portion of the talk, I would just suggest to you that as physicians, we may not have had a lot of training in this aspect, but that doesn't mean that if this isn't an important thing for you as a patient, that you shouldn't discuss it with your physician. And again, we have many resources to help us help you. And I think that unless you alert your physician to how we can help you, we may not necessarily see that. So I would just encourage you to, this is just another aspect of things that you can certainly discuss with your physician. I actually had an inspirational poem I was going to end with, but unfortunately I'm not the most computer savvy, and I brought my slides with me and I cannot open the program, and I didn't memorize the poem. It was actually a poem that was sent to me by a patient, and as I was leaving the office all fatutzed because I forgot this poem, I saw another inspirational plaque that a patient had sent that said, in essence, that a compassionate heart is always full. And I'll end on those notes. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gillum. Rabbi Arnowitz, if you want to come up now, please.
Thank you, Dr. Gillum. Beautiful talk, and certainly have heard more and more. It's been a TV show on TV now where there's a whole subplot of this spiritual approach versus a traditional medical approach to treatment of cancer is coming out as so it's clearly a something that people sense attention out there, and it's inspiring When I speak to doctors in the field, more often than not, actually, they are working very hard to combine the two and help and support in any way they can, understanding that this is an important part of treatment. So thank you for your words. It was nice. And you kept describing us as experts in spirituality. I don't know that this is. I don't know that there is such a thing per se. And defining spirituality, although you gave it a noble effort, I'm not so sure that is actually a possible thing, because spirituality is such a funny animal, right? There's everything that Dr. Gillum said. There is a sense of connection with the cosmic that could have nothing to do necessarily with religion. There is a sense of connection with the self that also may or may not have something to do with religion, all of which can be defined under spirituality, and all of which I think is relevant when we come to talking about a spiritual approach to coping through disease. So in 10 minutes, it might seem like I'm bouncing around a little, but hopefully if I touch on something that's interesting, you'll ask again during question and answer. I think one of the keys, personally, in the counseling that I've done and in the documents that I've read, one of the keys to having a spiritual element to healing is not to define spirituality in a narrow way. Right? This is going to be different for everyone. What makes someone feel spiritual uplift is different for everyone. No two people are the same. So I don't think any of us are going to stand up here and give you a formula for how to do this. There's not a right or a wrong way to approach spirituality. There's what works for you and maybe what works for someone else. So I think not narrowly defining it, not saying to yourself, well, someone told me I need to have a spiritual side of my treatment, and therefore, you know, I'm going to start taking yoga classes, you know, even though I've never, you know, even though I'm not necessarily sure what that is, let's say. You know, yoga might not be. Maybe you do it, maybe it's wonderful, maybe you do it and it doesn't, and it's not meaningful for you. And there's got to be that sense of journey. I think that's really the key to what I wanted to say, is that you know, this is a journey. It's an emotional journey, as well as obviously a physical journey and a spiritual journey. There is a book that was recommended to me by my aunt, who has survived several cancers, and it is called Cancer as a Turning Point. The author is a man named LeShan. I think he's a man anyway. Is it a man? LeShan. I shouldn't presume. A fantastic book that I would recommend to anyone. What I got out of that book more than anything else is this idea of that this is part of life's journey. This is not a beginning and it's not an end. A diagnosis is not a beginning and it is not an end. It is just a step on the path. Not just a step in the path, but it is a step on the path. And that ultimately to it can be used, a diagnosis, as a turning point, as a way to stop and look at life and what you've done up until now and figure out how to move forward and to experiment. And that is there's a spiritual element to that, but it's also incredibly emotional. The emotions that come with a cancer diagnosis of any sort are myriad feelings of, you know, betrayal from your own body. There are feelings of identity crisis, certainly with women's forms of cancers and men's forms of cancers. There are body image issues and femininity issues and masculinity issues, and all of this is, you know, all happening at a time of immense stress. And there's life and death issues. There's fear. So what do you do with all that emotion? How do you reach into all that emotion and come up with a spiritual, how can you even come up for air, no less find a spiritual place? It's ultimately a question, I think, to deal with. I learned the best answer for that from a chaplain who I did, when I was in rabbinical school, we had rotations. We had to follow around rabbis who did different things. And I followed around a wonderful, wonderful chaplain in North Jersey named Rabbi Herman Savitz, who is a beautiful, beautiful soul. And he was talking to a parent of a child with cancer. He had a son himself who had brain cancer. And he's talking to the father, talking to the mother, and the mother is expressing herself as best she can. The father is not saying a word. And he turned to this father and he said, "You know, I've been here too. I just want to tell you, don't be a storker. And if you don't speak Yiddish, a storker is someone who keeps it all bottled inside and just feels like they need to be, for whatever reason, stoic. Stoic would be a good expression of it. You know, ultimately, expressing yourself, I think, is a key to the spiritual journey. And it's not always easy to do. It's not always even clear how to. So a few ways, recommendations for different ways to express oneself that I think lend themselves to spirituality. First and foremost is your family, especially your partner, if you have one. You know, this is not only a journey of the person who's diagnosed with cancer. This is a journey for everyone who loves them, everyone who relies on them, and everyone who they rely on and who they love. And because of that, I think it's important to include them in the process, to understand that they're also going through a very scary period, a very difficult emotional period. And some of that spirituality actually comes from expressing to each other and being able to make that journey together. And it is not always easy. As the vast majority of counseling that I do related to cancer is actually couples counseling. Something interesting. But ultimately, almost all the couples who I've worked with have come through at the end of the journey and been able to say that we're actually stronger for it, that we discover new aspects of our relationship, and that their relationship has reached new levels. A turning point, an opportunity. When it comes to, it just happened to be serendipitous moments. I was listening to Dr. Dan Gottlieb earlier today on the radio, and he mentioned that that physical scars or, you know, wounds, they heal 1 millimeter a day, every day. And he said, we shouldn't think that emotional wounds are any different. And when it comes to a family that's been faced with a cancer diagnosis, everyone has those emotional wounds, and everyone is healing together. And it's important to keep that in mind and to allow that to happen. Two other things very quickly. The community. Having a spiritual community to turn to. Certainly, synagogues and churches can provide that space, and it's wonderful. They should. We have a Mishaberach list at our synagogue. Someone is facing a life-threatening illness. They tell our people, they go on the list. Every time we take the Torah out of the Ark, we say a special prayer of healing for them. And they know that's happening. And I've been told that that's very, very helpful for people to have that support. Some communities get creative with that. Sons of Israel, our local Orthodox synagogue, they have a Mishmeret HaLashon list. That means not speaking gossip. And that people would dedicate an hour of not speaking gossip to someone who's ailing, so that they would do a mitzvah, a good deed, a spiritual act on behalf of the person who is ill. And they would know that someone was taking an hour and doing something simple, but yet dedicating it to them. And that was a beautiful thing for them. There's other kind of communities that can and should be taken advantage of. The internet is an amazing resource now. Support groups on the internet. There's information on the internet, and I've been told it's a wonderful resource. And there's all these great organizations out there that survivors have created and people who just care have created. One that I've always been fascinated by is called Casting for Recovery. This is a group started by a fly fisherman. They bring groups of breast cancer patients or survivors on fly fishing trips. And they go for a week. They're going to Alaska this year to go fly fishing together. Apparently, and you would be able to tell more, but apparently the actual action of casting a fly fishing rod is comforting somehow, feels good. On top of that, it's a whole group of these people who maybe don't have this community to support to talk to get support from, all supporting each other. So there's all kinds of ways to find community in all kinds of places. It's just a matter of being open to it. And lastly, is, of course, the spiritual place where I turn and where I'd hope people are comfortable turning, which is God. And I brought, which I will not share with you because they're fairly long, a whole packet of ceremonies, rituals that people have created in order to help them with every step of their journey. And I just want to tell you a few of the occasions where people have found useful to have one of these rituals. And if you're interested in Jewish rituals, there's a website called ritualwell.org that has lists and lists of these that people have shared. It's a wonderful resource. But people that have written meditation before a mastectomy, clearly a transitional moment in their lives. A meditation for radiation treatment called Faith Zap Love, which I just love. Just love the name of it, right? And every time she was zapped, she had a different prayer. It's four times a week. She had four prayers, one for each time. And that meditation helped her through it. A woman who, 18 years after her mastectomy, created a ritual to go with the Jewish ritual of Havdalah to celebrate the life that she's built for herself since that point. This one I found, I didn't know what to think of exactly, but a woman who created a funeral ceremony for her womb after hysterectomy, who actually did a whole burial, beautiful and powerful ceremony, which I had never seen before. And all kinds of spiritual moments to grasp onto there. If you're not sure how to grasp onto them, then find a clergy person, find a coach, a guide, someone who can help you with this, help you find a place, a spot where you can go to meditate. But ultimately, it's all about, in a sense, it seems weird, it seems counterintuitive, but as I have learned from survivors and experts alike, it seems to me that viewing this disease as an opportunity is the best way to move forward from it, and that's really where the spirituality of the whole process comes from. So.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Arnowitz. Reverend Brivingali, please come up. I'm totally tongue-twisting on that. I apologize.
Well, thank you for inviting me to come today and have an Italian Presbyterian who grew up Roman Catholic. But I've always grown up in a household of faith, and that's been so very precious to me. Right now, I am the executive presbyter of the Presbytery of West Jersey, which is 65 Presbyterian churches in South Jersey. But prior to July of this year, I was the pastor of the Presbyterian Church in Burlington for over 23 years. It was an incredibly warm, loving, and caring congregation. We were basically an extended family. I sat with many people as they received the news that they were diagnosed with cancer. And being a hospital chaplain for 25 years and getting called in many times, you constantly hear people with stories that they wanted to share with you or just ask questions about what does that mean to be finally faced with some of these diagnoses and where is God when I need God. So I helped to interpret many times probably words like Dr. Gillum would speak to people when your mind gets a little fuzzy and you just don't hear everything and they wanted somebody else to interpret that. And especially reading between the lines if a reoccurrence came. What does all that mean? I'd prayed with people, assuring them that God was with them and their church family was there for them. We encouraged people to share in worship during our time of joys and concerns, what it is they were thinking or feeling, and allowing other people to encourage them as they walk through that journey. I even wrote a doctoral dissertation about stewardship of the end of life, encouraging people to discern what they felt God was telling them life was all about, to acknowledge that life is a gift from God, and inviting people to have conversation with their loved ones about issues such as advanced directives, organ donation, and more, long before there's any need to have that conversation. But nothing I did prepared me to hear the words, "You have cancer." Suddenly, an intelligent person becomes a blithering idiot. Couldn't think of a single thing to say. New Year's Day 2005, I found a lump in my left breast. And being 49 and finding all the women in my church, oh yeah, you've got fibroids and you've got cysts and you've got all these other good things. It's that thing right around menopause time, right? So I wasn't too worried because nobody in my family had cancer. January 4th, saw a gynecologist who sent me for the ultrasound and gave me the name of a breast surgeon saying, "Nah, you might just need to get it taken care of just in case." January 18, my husband and I go to a surgeon who the first words out of his mouth were, "You have cancer." And he then went on to explain that it was aggressive and fast-growing and it was time to get it out. February 4th, lumpectomy, chemo. March 4th, 8 cycles. 35 radiation treatments. 10 months later, treatment was done. I went to the web looking for information. Did you know that there are 2,476,132 websites about breast cancer? Trying to discern where you get all kinds of information is really hard. So with my congregation, I decided to practice what I preached, and I shared my diagnosis. And sharing that with your congregation, I had an elder spontaneously just jump up and come up front, and we all started praying together. The leadership of the church said we would journey together, and we became prayer partners. Our local paper, I contacted, and they followed me on the journey through everything. They took pictures of going into surgery, having chemo, radiation, just to show what that incredible journey is all about. Every week, I would tell my congregation what were the side effects of the week's activities. After my first chemo, I made the mistake of telling them that animal crackers tasted pretty good. Do you know what 20 pounds of animal crackers look like? Now, my husband and my dad are my family, and they were there for me not only physically but spiritually. We had open conversations about what if. And no matter what happened, it was going to be okay. I wasn't afraid, but more uncertain. It's like riding a roller coaster. You don't know what's going to happen when you get over that rise. But knowing people were praying for me made all the difference in the world. Entering surgery, I knew I had people in 11 countries and 27 states praying. And even the doctors and oncologists and radiation oncologists that I encountered appreciated knowing they were being prayed for. And I intentionally asked them if they were people of faith. That was important to me in my treatment. So my surgeon was Jewish, my oncologist was Roman Catholic, and the radiation oncologist was Mormon. So I covered all the bases. But prayer partners were very crucial. Knowing on a day when I wasn't feeling the best or not knowing what to pray for, knowing other people were there doing that for me. A prayer quilt from the congregation that as each person went and tied a knot in it, they offered a prayer. And our presbytery means our churches are connected to one another. They constantly were engaged in conversation with me. Now, I wore my clerical collar to all my treatments and my appointments and invited conversation. And I had some really good conversations with people. But two were very poignant. What did you do wrong that God gave you cancer? If you were truly a woman of faith, you never should have gotten cancer because your faith should have saved you. So it was very interesting having conversations with people talking about how we believe that God works through human gifts that God has given to men and women of faith. But ultimately, to us, God is the great physician. And I would see a difference in attitude between people of faith and those who constantly looked for the latest thing, who had the latest trend each and every day, who had a book to read each and every week that was going to solve their problems or get them through it. There's a difference between an attitude of hope and promise. I came away with a different respect for caregivers who feel so helpless when their loved ones are ill. And how many times we walk up and we ask the person how their loved one is and forget about the person that we're asking about. Believed in a sense of shalom, the wholeness that comes when we are complete. And that is heart, body, mind, soul, and spirit all together, working together. One last thought for me, what I did is I found that God was so very poignant in nature, and sometimes it would be a card that would come on a given day, a phone call. You just never knew how God was going to be speaking to you. I decided to do a journal, recording daily thoughts. And sometimes, like Job, I would shake my fist and go, "This is not any fun." And other times I'd say, "I'm doing this, and it's going to be okay, because I know you're with me, O Lord." And that's what relationship is in spirituality, because I think the words are interchangeable. The relationship that we build in our with God and with one another helps to define us as spiritual people and helps us to be able to encounter everything that we find in life each and every day. And I think that it's just wonderful that we can be there for one another and to walk this journey with each other. And that's a great gift that God has given to each of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Last but not least, Bonnie Mayer.
Well, becoming a cancer survivor starts the moment a patient is diagnosed. And at Cooper Cancer Institute, we realize that physical healing is only part of our mission. That's why we created the Dr. Diane Barton Complementary Medicine Program. I must say, I'm Pastor Debbie, I'm moved to the fact when you say, people, if they went into surgery and you blessed everybody and people blessed you and what have you. I remember when Dr. Barton, she was a Cooper internal medicine and geriatric specialist, and she was recognized regionally as a top doc. Diane fought a long and valiant struggle with ovarian cancer, but lost her battle in 2004. And I remember, literally, she, as a doctor, her patients knew. And when she would have to have a surgery or go in for a treatment, people would hand her, you know, a little brown bag, and inside was the water from Lourdes, you know, the waters of Lourdes, and little, you know, all sorts of prayer cards and what have you, and she took them all. Graciously and happily. That brought back a very fond memory. She is missed by her colleagues, patients, friends, and family, but her legacy lives on through the Dr. Diane Barton Complementary Medicine Program. Diane believed strongly in the value of complementary medicine as a way to deal with the side effects of cancer treatment and as an aid to recovery. This important program enhances the quality of life and wellness of individuals touched by cancer, including patients, their caregivers, and family members. It utilizes therapies that focus on mind, body, and spirit while supporting mainstream medical care. The complementary therapies offered through this program are designed to lessen pain, stress, and anxiety associated with cancer. They also provide assistance in handling the side effects of such traditional treatments as radiation and chemotherapy. While complementary therapies cannot cure cancer, many patients have found them to be helpful in managing and coping with their cancer. While traditional medicine and healthcare treat the illness, complementary medicine therapies help promote wellness in the whole person. In addition to the therapeutic benefits, taking part in complementary medicine therapies empowers participants, providing them with an opportunity to take a positive, active role in their care and treatment. Our complementary medicine programs include, but are not limited to, restorative yoga, mindfulness meditation, guided imagery, Qigong, music therapy, creative arts, behavioral workshops, body movement classes, therapeutic chair massage, and reflexology. I want to just give you an idea of what we're talking about. As many as 61% of cancer patients use complementary therapies such as meditation, massage, and relaxation techniques. Cancer has a way of leading people toward a search for meaning. The search has more to do with a growing need for spirituality. Some may say that religion and spirituality are the same, but spirituality and religion, I believe, are indeed different. Spirituality is a connection to and a reverence for all that is universal. Spirituality has no doctrine and no formal rules for a belief system. Spiritual health is often considered a condition marked by a diminished sense of fear and the daily experience of unconditional love, joy, gratitude, and a personal relationship with God. Religion can play a part in guiding us to the path of spirituality, but religion is simply a bridge to spirituality. There are many religions, but only one spiritual truth. This spiritual truth is the journey home to yourself and the understanding of your emotional courage, truth, and honesty as you go through your journey. Spirituality can be found anywhere. You can experience it in a church or a temple, in the revel of nature, in a yoga, dance, or exercise class, in the darkest, most unlikely place. Spirituality is a state of mind. It is an experience that brings you closer to the realization of life's truths. It can be found when facing fear, enjoying simplicity, or contemplation. A diagnosis of cancer compels a person to ask the ultimate human questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What happens to me after I'm gone? I believe that religion and spirituality have a very important place in life, especially when confronting these complex existential issues. Although we rarely acknowledge the fact that we are mortal, having cancer begs us to look mortality right in the eyes. So why is it important to have a sense of spirituality? It is important because it will help you to live better. It will help you to live with a heightened sense of hope and meaning. It will serve you in more ways than you realize. The beauty of spirituality is that it enables you to create your own private place of being. Is it prayer? It can be. It doesn't have to be. Is it meditation? It can be, but again, it's not defined as that. Spirituality is contemplating anything and everything in relation to your sense of being, finding personal significance in the seemingly insignificant, and to that which holds the greatest significance, your relationship with God. A life-threatening disease such as cancer confronts us with realities and questions that prompts us to step back from our lives and reflect on the meaning and implications of the illness. Our perspective on these realities and questions emerges in large measure from our religious, spiritual, or philosophical orientation, and it influences how we experience the illness, its meaning, how we feel about it, and how we will come to terms with it. A religious perspective can help us as we grapple with these issues and seek to keep our bearing through the mental and emotional turmoil that comes with having cancer. The diagnosis of cancer confronts us with the fact that we are vulnerable to disease and suffering, that we are mortal and that our time is limited. When we are in good health, these realities often reside at the back of our minds. But when a serious illness strikes, they surge forward and challenge us. They challenge us especially with the question of whether we are using our time wisely. This question is linked to what our time is for, to what our life is all about. For many, these questions take on a central, compelling importance, which is why cancer is commonly referred to as a wake-up call. Usually, the most pressing priority when we are faced with the diagnosis of cancer is to regain our good health. If we succeed, the implications of our mortality might once again slip into the background. Sometimes the illness is regarded only as a temporary bump in the road of life, as opposed to a stark reminder of life's fragility. But more often than not, cancer has a way of capturing our attention, deepening our reflection on what is important, and causing us to live with more awareness of ultimate priorities. Patients who are fighting for their lives can be strengthened and sustained by a clear vision of what they want to survive for. Many talk of surviving for the sake of their families, to meet certain life goals, and to fulfill certain inner potentials or strivings. Whatever a person's answer, it reflects deeply held religious, spiritual, or philosophical beliefs about what is important and why. As cancer patients reflect on their ultimate priorities, they often identify changes that they wish to make in themselves or their life. This is often referred to as the enlightenment of cancer or the gift of cancer. Countless patients have commented that they regret that it took a cancer diagnosis to wake them up and capture their attention. But they feel that many positive and overdue changes in themselves and their life have resulted from it. In making these changes, these patients have found some positive meaning in their illness. I'm going to leave you with this quote. Happiness cannot be traveled to, earned, worn, or consumed. Happiness is the spiritual experience of living every moment with love, grace, and gratitude. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions that they want to ask?
This question, I think, as directed, I think it was the Reverend, who was, you said that people have said or you had thought that cancer is an opportunity. Are you the one that said, someone said that. Someone said cancer is an opportunity, but I'm wondering how long that takes when someone gets a diagnosis. Usually it's so devastating, it's like they're being killed that minute. And then I've heard it said, you know, maybe after radiation or chemo is done, they see the light. But have you experienced various lengths of time between people?
It depends on the person, it depends on the cancer, you know, it depends on the treatment. And not everyone always gets there. You know, it's an opportunity. Opportunity, you know, can lead a horse to water, right? But you can't help them drink. The best you can do, I think, is the lead a horse to water part, right? I mean, you know, certainly it takes time. It is a massive paradigm shift in someone's mind, anyone's mind, no matter how comfortable they've been with their own mortality their entire life. You know, I know of police officers and firefighters who, you know, face death every day, and then they have cancer and they think their life is over, you know, and that somehow manifests itself differently, you know, in their spirit and in their mind. So there's no question it takes some getting used to. And it takes, you know, some searching around. In fact, Pastor Debbie, you probably explained that better than I can. I only have, you know, secondary evidence. But ultimately, I guess what I was trying to say is that it's giving yourself the opportunity. It's surrounding yourself with the resources and trying to take that journey, not allowing yourself to be paralyzed, but reaching out to family, friends, community, searching deep down inside to try and get there, because I've certainly seen people go the opposite route, people who just decided that day that their life was over and have just been letting themselves wither ever since. Some people for decades, actually. So,
I would just personally, as a therapist, I just don't think I would say that to somebody right away if they come in and they're devastated. Oh, you'll see, it's an opportunity. I would think I'd get smacked in the face. But I was just wondering, you know, at what point, I guess it's a different for everyone when they accept it, or if, like you said, some people never get there.
Anybody else have any other questions?
I have a comment. I don't know if it's exactly an opportunity, but I do know that very shortly after my diagnosis, I have no spirituality. I have no religion. I'm like a totally secular person. But I immediately decided that this was probably the worst thing that could ever happen to me. And I immediately decided that as long as I had to cope with this, I wasn't going to cope with anything else that was negative in my life. So I immediately stopped talking to two people. Just boom, like they're dead. I'm not dead, they're dead. And that helped. And this is, my diagnosis was in December of 2005. And I've noticed that since then, I've kind of had that attitude about other things. Like if there's something that I don't want to do or I'm uncomfortable doing or somebody that I'm uncomfortable speaking to, I just don't do it. I've eliminated an awful lot of shoulds. Gee, I should do this. I should do this. Nah, I'm a human being, not a human doing. And so it's helped me that way. But if you had told me on the day of my diagnosis that this was an opportunity to have a better quality of life, I'm sure it would have laughed in your face. So I agree that that's not what you want to hear the day of. Although, I will say that when I went in and my doctor told me that it was breast cancer, he didn't have to tell me. I just said, I know it's breast cancer, so what do we do now? And he said, oh, but this is the best kind because it's early stage and you're going to be, well, he didn't know I was going to need chemo and radiation and blah, blah, blah. But at least he was as upbeat as he could be without saying, this is an opportunity.
And I would really recommend this book, because that's what this book, Cancer as a Turning Point by Lishan, is about, to any therapist or your own clergy person or doctor or to a patient. It really captures, it's just a beautiful work that really captures exactly that idea, that there's a sense of living for yourself that's the should, right? Is that you should be living for yourself and that maybe this is, you know, your body telling you that you should.
I also stopped talking to my mother-in-law. Was that before
or after your diagnosis?
But it's kind of like you have to, you prioritize, you start learning when you have to focus some of your attention on you, then you have to prioritize what's really important in life. And then you realize that there are some people that things that you've been doing that you really don't have to be doing. You've been doing them because you feel like you have to. Now you do things because you want to. And, that is, it's something that you find as you get through things. But, you get your energy level back and, well, maybe I'll do this. But, no, maybe I don't have to anymore either. You give yourself permission, like you said, to be the human being.
If I can add from the physician standpoint, from the standpoint of breast cancer treatment and survival, most women, by far and away, most women that I see from the standpoint of their medical outcome are likely to do well. So from a survival standpoint, I can reassure them in that regard. But from my perspective, because so many women are surviving breast cancer, it's not enough to just survive it. I want to see and hope to see that they heal from it, that they get over it, so to speak, and that somehow it does contribute to ultimately a better person, a better them, a better life. So it's just interesting from my perspective because for so long we've, struggled with the pure survival. But I think now we're entering an age where we diagnose breast cancer earlier, and by far and away most women do survive. But if they survive in a bitter state with fractured relationships, and is that really good? I think we can do better than that.
I think it's interesting that you bring that up because there's something called I call it the art of survivorship, and once you finish your treatment and let's say you've been 5 years, 10 years, we're seeing survivors live. 15, 20, 30 years. I know so many survivors through the Diane Barton program that are long-term survivors, active, healthy, vibrant women. And there is an art to survivorship. It's not just about saying, okay, I had cancer once, but now I'm fine, so I'm going to go back to my life and pretend it never happened. It's more about once you're diagnosed, you're considered a survivor. And you're always in that club, whether you like it or not, you're always in that club. So I say make it special.
and make your journey with that club memorable, in the sense that maybe in the beginning of your diagnosis and treatment, you're not prepared to, in any way, shape, or form, to be a part of contributing to that club. But, you know, many years out, or at some point when you feel it, you may have an aha moment where you say, you know what, I have a story, I have something, you know, to tell. I want to go join, you know, I want to take a yoga class with different survivors, or I want to, you know, come to Cooper Cancer Institute, and I want to do the tea cart and be a volunteer, and we go around to other infusion patients having infusion, and I want to hold a hand and give a cup of tea because I want to contribute back. And to me, that art of survivorship can be an incredible journey.
Bear with me. I'm not quite sure what my question is, but I'm kind of chuckling to myself, thinking about asking a doctor if they are a person of faith. So I'm just wondering if you have a lot of colleagues that share your wisdom and your approach to this caring side of medicine. It's hard enough to kind of swim through the medical waters these days. So being able to sit and talk to your doctor about your faith obviously takes time, which they don't always want to give. So I would just like to hear a little bit more about that.
Well, you're very kind to say that about my approach, but I do think that there are many physicians who function that way, but I do think you hit the nail on the head in a sense that oftentimes their schedules and the demands of trying to see a lot of patients in a day can prevent it from being really visible. But one of the things that I found, I was in that hurried mode for a long time, and I'm trying to think of a good way to express this, but it's like taking one step forward and three back. And, you know, you can rush through a discussion and blurt the words out and pass it on to your nurse to deal with, but invariably it sort of comes around again. So it made sense to take the time at that time, because it in the long run pays off so much more, that before for a patient to go all the way to panic and then come back again is a much harder journey than for us to take the time initially to try to explain things. I think knowledge is a very reassuring thing in general. So that the more that we can explain, the more the patient understands, the less frightening that things are. To be very honest with you, there's also a selfish side to it, because I have to face my own mortality sometime. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy listening to patients and understanding how they're doing it, so that ultimately that might help me when my time comes.
If I could just add, you made me think of something. It's not only doctors who sometimes take a routine approach to cancer treatment. In this day and age, it's funny, not ha-ha funny, but it is odd that, you know, I'm sure you've seen this, we were just talking earlier, but it's so prevalent, especially breast cancer right now, especially among young women, I'm finding. Anecdotally, I am speaking to a lot of young women with breast cancer, and it's almost becoming so common that, you know, the initial reaction is, okay, it's just a disease, and my friend had this, and how do we get it out, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to move on. And so it almost seems like patients are starting to get a little more, you know, routine about it, and not necessarily, sooner or later, everyone's got to deal with it. I personally believe it will catch up. But I think that that's an opportunity, there's that word again, perhaps a little loaded, but at the time of diagnosis and treatment, to actually have to face it then, I think it might be harder further on down the line.
Does anybody have any last thoughts that they may have or questions they may have? Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone, for coming. I want to thank Komen for the Cure, Philadelphia affiliate, for funding Yad B'Yad and making programs like this possible. Hopefully all of you filled out a registration form, and what that enables us to do is to keep you informed of future programs that are in the works. Sometime in January, we're going to have an open mic night at the Pink Ribbon Cafe in Cherry Hill, and also sometime in March, we're going to have a program. We're bringing in a group from Baltimore called Men Against Breast Cancer, and it's a program that helps the men who are helping loved ones fighting with breast cancer. It's going to be a program for couples with something together and then something separate and then bringing everybody back together again. So I wanted to thank you all so much for coming. There's brochures. If you want to learn anything more about Yad B'Yad or Cancer Connection and any other ways that Samos Jewish Family and Children's Services can help, please call anytime. We're always available and we're here for you guys. So thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this program from the Samost Jewish Family and Children's Service of Southern New Jersey. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, please send us an email. You can write to steve@professionalpodcasts.com. If you would like more information on cancer support for cancer survivors and their families, contact the Samost Jewish Family and Children's Service of Southern New Jersey at area code 856-424-1333 or visit the website at jfcssnj.org. We produce this program in the studios of professionalpodcasts.com in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For the Jewish Family and Children's Service of Southern New Jersey and everyone at the Jewish Federation of Southern New Jersey, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.